This is Community Voices on 91.9 UIS. I'm co-host Randy Eccles. Today, an event you may have missed, the 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series, The Age of Disruption. Today is the second part. We'll hear from Colleen Shogan, who was the Archivist of the United States. She'll talk about Lincoln's legacy, the archives, and civics. Here's Jake Freifeld, director of the UIS Center for Lincoln Studies, to introduce Colleen Shogan.
Our next speaker is going to bring our discussion of disruption to our own time. The tie to Lincoln in her lecture is clear. Because while for us Lincoln is a subject of history, Lincoln was keenly aware of the power that lay in historical narratives and the danger in distorting them. When the Supreme Court issued the Dred Scott decision, and Justice Taney argued that all men created equal didn't apply to all men, and that any attempt to bar slavery from federal territory took the meaning of the Constitution beyond the framers' original intent, Lincoln called out that distortion. He detailed the ways in which the founding generation explicitly limited slavery in the case of the old Northwest Territory, and even dictated the conditions under which slavery could exist in new slave states like Mississippi. Lincoln understood the power of historical narrative to shape national truth. And we as Americans came to understand that very well over the centuries after the Civil War. So we established our national cultural institutions and historical institutions to be nonpartisan. Our next speaker will discuss why that nonpartisanship and our cultural institutions is so important and perhaps under threat today. Our speaker served as the 11th Archivist of the United States and the first woman in American history appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate to lead the National Archives. She is a noted author and political scientist. She is deeply committed to civics education and is a senior advisor at More Perfect, an alliance of 37 presidential centers and hundreds of civic leaders and organizations that invites Americans to consider the most enduring lessons of our history while informing the future of our democracy. It's my honor to introduce Colleen Shogan.
Well, thank you so much for that warm welcome. It's certainly an honor to be here in Springfield, Abraham Lincoln City, where echoes of his legacy still reverberate in the streets, at this university, in the archives, and in our democratic imagination. We meet near the site of one of the most consequential speeches in American history, Lincoln's House Divided address. And in that speech, he did something rare and deeply courageous. He confronted the growing divisions of his time with moral clarity and democratic conviction. He recognized that a nation split against itself could not endure. And yet, he did not retreat into bitterness or ideology. He held fast to the universal truths critical for the nation's future. So Lincoln understood something that we must grasp in our own time. The endurance of this republic depends not just on elections and politicians, but on the shared memory and history that binds us together. In a democracy, historical memory is not a luxury. It is a civic necessity. Our cultural institutions, namely archives, libraries, and museums, are the keepers of that memory. They preserve not just artifacts, but the evidence of who we have been, who we are, and who we aspire to become. They are the connective tissue of our civic life, helping to transmit values and understanding across generations. They represent the best aspirations of our democratic project, namely a collective understanding of our national story. Every morning as I walk through the Pennsylvania Avenue entrance at the National Archives in our nation's capital, I passed underneath a carved inscription. What is past is prologue. It's a line from Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. There is perhaps no better way of stating why the preservation and study of history matter. It is not just about remembering. It is about preparing for the hard work in a democracy that must continue. It is about drawing from the past to navigate the present and to shape the future. Everything that has happened before merely sets the stage for what is to come. Neither democracy nor historical inquiry is a spectator sport. It requires activity and engagement. Citizens must participate to keep democracy alive and to keep history relevant. A healthy democracy demands active questioning, local engagement, dialogue, and community involvement. Historical inquiry requires the same vigilance: to challenge previously accepted narratives, to uncover hidden stories, and to prevent the distortion of truth. Indeed, the study of history and civic life go hand in hand with each other. It is only through the study of history that we understand how people who came before us had to fight to protect and to expand their rights. That phrase, "what is past is prologue," served as a daily reminder of the responsibility entrusted to all of us who worked at the National Archives. My job as the head of that institution was to document the full spectrum of the American experience. That includes moments of triumph in American history and moments of failure. In doing so, we serve not only history, but democracy itself. So first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the National Archives. Now, how many people here have visited the National Archives in Washington, D.C.? How many people have visited a presidential library somewhere across the United States? Okay, yeah, well, So many Americans don't know that presidential libraries from Herbert Hoover to President George W. Bush are part of the National Archives system. So the National Archives is the most important federal government agency that until a few years ago you never heard anything about. That's because the work done by NARA, the National Archives and Records Administration, is emblematic of government well executed. When government functions well, it operates in the background, quietly and without much controversy. The National Archives has an incredible mission. Its job is to preserve, protect, and share our nation's records. That format can be paper, it can be an electronic file, it can be a digital photograph, it can be a map, a video, a poster, an email, or an instant message. So how many records does the National Archives preserve? The estimate is 13.5 billion pieces of paper, not million, billion pieces of paper, 700,000 artifacts, 41 million photographs, 10 million maps, and over a petabyte of electronic data. The latter will grow rapidly in the next decade, with the total number of born electronic records moving from 500 million pages to billions very rapidly, and then soon to trillions. So why do we preserve this tremendous number of records? There's several reasons, but transparency about government operations is fundamental to a democracy. Now, Abraham Lincoln said it best when he described democratic government as of the people, by the people, and for the people. Without transparency, there is no accountability, thus precluding the type of government Lincoln spoke about at the end of the Gettysburg Address. Americans access records to claim their rights and their benefits. This happens every day at the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri, not that far from here, a National Archives facility which houses the military records of our nation's veterans. Without such documentation and access to records, veterans would not be able to demonstrate their legal right to the protections they are due. Finally, we also need access to government records to tell the stories of our past. American history and its interpretations cannot be written, discussed, or debated without a robust National Archives. Archives are valuable because they possess one-of-a-kind pieces of information. The records in an archive are rare and often not found anywhere else. Providing a firsthand account of an event, a person's actions, or a period in history, the archives provide the data for historians to accomplish their work. So now that I've provided a brief overview of the National Archives, the agency that I led for almost 2 years, I'd like to really move into the heart of my lecture. So today, I want to talk about a disruption. Not the kind that arrives with considerable fanfare or flourish, but the kind that seeps in slowly, almost invisibly. The creeping politicization of our cultural and historical institutions is one of the most dangerous trends we face as a democratic republic. It is subtle, not at the top of the fold headlines we see about issues like immigration, the federal budget, taxes, or international affairs. But it is deeply corrosive, and I would argue just as important as the most pressing policies we debate routinely. So let me say something both controversial and truthful. We take many of our government's functions for granted. As citizens, we have come to expect them to work well, and I would put cultural institutions in that category. For decades, they have operated in the background, always there for Americans, preserving, protecting, and sharing our nation's history. And now they are under threat, so it's time to bring them from the background and into the limelight so we can focus on them and deal with the fact that if we break them, it will take more than a generation to fix them. Disruption is the theme of this forum, and it is the backdrop of our current moment. We are living through a period shaped by profound change, the rise of artificial intelligence and disinformation, the explosion of social media, widespread distrust in government, racial unrest, economic inequality, and existential questions about what it means to be an American. We are seeing new pressures every day concerning our public's willingness to recognize shared facts. We're also living through a crisis of knowledge. In this environment, facts are contested, expertise is suspect, and truth itself becomes negotiable. Amid this confusion, our cultural institutions are being asked to engage in roles they were never meant to play. Instead of serving as nonpartisan stewards of history, they are being pulled into ideological battles. There are growing calls, some overt and some whispered, for these institutions to choose sides. In doing so, they are urged to interpret the past in service of the present. And in some cases, they are being asked to reduce their public outreach and eliminate stakeholder feedback. The independence that once protected these institutions is increasingly under assault. Of course, the clearest evidence of such a problem is my dismissal as Archivist of the United States. There was no stated reason for my removal. When asked to provide a reason, the White House fell silent. That is because there was no justifiable reason for terminating me. I did nothing wrong, and I certainly did not act unlawfully or unprofessionally. I took my promise to serve in a nonpartisan fashion seriously. Many have speculated that I was removed from my position due to a desire to politicize the institution, enabling the placement of leadership at the archives willing to engage in political machinations. The same has been said for my friend Dr. Carla Hayden, who was likewise dismissed from her position as Librarian of Congress, also for no legitimate reason. I cannot say for certain why either of these dismissals happened, and perhaps we will never know. However, let me be clear. Politicization will result in a betrayal of mission. It is a disservice to the American people, to history, and to democracy itself. Institutions such as the National Archives, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Institution, and the Kennedy Center are not Republican or Democratic entities. They are not instruments of political agendas. They are the American people's institutions. Their legitimacy and their very purpose depends on their ability to remain nonpartisan, principled, and transparent. Even before my dismissal, there were several harbingers of politicization. As I executed my job without attention to political outcomes, I was criticized by both political parties. Republicans were upset when they asked for records from the Biden vice presidency, and I followed the established law and regulations to provide them with access. Democrats wanted me to publish the Equal Rights Amendment as part of the Constitution when the congressionally established deadline for ratification expired in 1981. You know you're doing something right as a nonpartisan leader when both sides of the aisle are angry with you. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 2026, we are presented with a rare opportunity. Although I am enthusiastic about celebrating our great nation and its history, this anniversary should be more than a big party of flag waving and fireworks. It should be a civic reckoning. This is a moment to reflect honestly on our past, to consider our present circumstances, and recommit to our future. The promises laid out in the Declaration of Independence were bold, radical even, that all men are created equal, endowed with unalienable rights. Never before in human history had there been such a pronouncement. But as we know, these words were not a reflection of reality. They were a challenge to it. They were a promise yet fulfilled. Frederick Douglass knew that in his famous 1852 speech, "What to the Slave is the Fourth of July," he delivered an unsparing critique of American hypocrisy while still expressing faith in the ideals of the Declaration. That duality, critique and faith in the American creed, is the very essence of civic responsibility.
Colleen Shogan on critique and faith being core to our democracy. This event you may have missed on Community Voices today is the Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series for 2025. Coming back with more after this. Community Voices today is an event you may have missed, the 2025 Lincoln Legacy Lecture. Here, Colleen Shogan, the former archivist for the United States, continues with thoughts about Frederick Douglass and his optimism for our government to deal with slavery.
Douglass stated, "I have said that the Declaration of Independence is the ring bolt to the chain of your destiny. So indeed, I regard it. The principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by those principles, be true to them on all occasions and in all places, against all foes, and at whatever cost." After explaining the hypocrisy of slavery's existence with the principles of the Declaration, he went on in the speech to conclude, "Allow me to say, notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. The arm of the Lord is not shortened, and the doom of slavery is certain. I therefore leave off where I began, with hope. While drawing encouragement from the Declaration of Independence, the great principles it contains, and the genius of American institutions, my spirit is also cheered by the obvious tendencies of the age." Abraham Lincoln also believed in the principles of the Declaration, yet he knew that reform and disruption was needed. And so did generations of Americans who fought for abolition, women's suffrage, civil rights, and other movements that sought to bring the nation closer to its founding ideals. Their struggle was rooted in the belief that the American experiment was worth improving, that the arc of the moral universe could be bent towards justice, but not without effort. The Declaration of Independence was itself a disruption, an audacious statement in world history, but it was never self-executing. The fulfillment of its promise has always required struggle, sacrifice, and civic engagement. Democracies are never static. They are like gardens, always requiring care and replanting so that they can diversify and continue to grow. I tend to a flower garden every year in front of my house, and it would certainly be a fool's errand simply to plant it in the spring and ignore it for the rest of the summer. It requires weeding, watering, and constant attention. Democracies require the same care and feeding, or they stagnate and eventually die. That is why, during my tenure as Archivist of the United States, I made the decision to add the Emancipation Proclamation to permanent display inside the National Archives Rotunda. The Emancipation Proclamation did not end racial injustice, but it was a necessary beginning, a pivotal step towards aligning our nation's ideals with our national actions. It deserves to sit beside the Declaration of Independence because it represents Lincoln's effort to recommit the United States to its founding principles. And thank goodness, my decision has not been changed, as of yet, since my departure. As far as I know, the Emancipation Proclamation will join the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights in the National Archives Rotunda next year. I am grateful that cooler heads have prevailed and this important addition has not been reversed. It is fitting to add a record from Lincoln's handiwork into this hallowed space. No one understood the moral dimensions of disruption better than Lincoln. He believed that the Constitution must be a living framework, one that is constantly in motion towards justice and equality. During the Civil War, when expedient compromises were tempting, Lincoln instead clung to a moral vision rooted to the founding principle of equality. He saw the Declaration as the apple of gold framed by the Constitution's frame of silver. In other words, the Constitution derives its meaning from the principles it is meant to uphold. So today, we must recover Lincoln's approach, not romanticizing these ideals, but fulfilling the responsibility that accompanies them. Not blind celebration, but honest stewardship. We must remember that disruption, when guided by principle, can lead us to redemption and renewal. But we are also witnessing a different kind of disruption, one that does not seek to expand understanding, but to narrow it. Some now argue that cultural institutions are inherently biased and should be reshaped or even dismantled to serve specific political ends. That is not reform. It is historical vandalism dressed in the language of hollow patriotism. Nonpartisanship is not the evasion of principles. In fact, it's precisely the opposite. It is a commitment to transparency, to access, and to integrity. The role of a nonpartisan federal institution is not to settle debates, but to equip citizens to engage in them. That is why archives, libraries, and museums must resist the temptation to curate history according to political preferences. We must trust the American people enough to present them with a full record, even when it's messy and even when it's painful. As I said earlier, the National Archives preserves more than 13.5 billion pages of documents. These records are not always convenient. They are challenging. They include the Emancipation Proclamation and Japanese internment orders, the GI Bill and redlining maps, speeches that inspired civil rights marches, and policies that denied people their basic dignity. To tell only part of the story would be easier, but it would also be dishonest and simply inaccurate. Our mission is to preserve the integrity of the American record. When that record is manipulated, distorted, or selectively quoted, we lose more than historical accuracy. We lose the civic trust that underpins democracy itself. Disruption is a tool. Its value lies in how it's used and by whom. The Declaration of Independence was a disruption. So was abolition, so was women's suffrage, so was the civil rights movement, and so was the push for marriage equality. But not all disruptions are principled. Today, the language of disruption is sometimes used as a cover to dismantle institutions, to silence dissent, or rewrite history in service of ideology. That is not progress. Unfortunately, that is regression. We must be careful in how we respond to these threats. The remedy should not be as bad as the disease. So I argue that the response to these threats must be principled. We must reaffirm our commitment to nonpartisanship, to professional standards, and transparency. We must safeguard the ability of institutions to preserve memory, to foster inquiry and inspire civic participation. We must protect the freedom to study history without fear, distortion, or interference. Remaining nonpartisan in a polarized age takes courage. It means resisting political pressure, even when subtle or well-intentioned. It means defending professional independence. It means upholding standards that are older than any controversy and more enduring than any administration. And sometimes it means telling the President of the United States, a member of Congress, or a wealthy influencer that no, you cannot do something because it does not follow the processes outlined in law or the Constitution. I want to caution that if the political tides shift, we should resist calls for retribution. Our nation's historical and cultural institutions should be restored. Funding will have been removed or reduced, capabilities will have been lessened, and there will likely be a need to rebuild the human capital associated with this sector. Such rebuilding will take hard work. However, we must avoid tilting these institutions in the opposite direction too far. They are not a political seesaw. The value in them is their constancy and their equilibrium. That is what has been disrupted and must be reestablished. In the meantime, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration gives us a chance to reset, to ask, what does it mean to be an American in the 21st century? Civic renewal begins with civic education, but education is not indoctrination. It is meaningful engagement and exploration. It's the opportunity to think critically, to ask questions, and form your own conclusions based upon evidence. In our new push for civics education, we must teach the Declaration of Independence not as a dead text, but as a living challenge. We must teach the Constitution not as a relic, but as a responsibility. And we must help young people see that history is not a straight line, but a contested space that demands their attention and their participation. Public institutions cannot thrive without the support of our citizens. They were built for the people, but they must be defended by the people too. We must not only teach civic literacy, we must model it. So people often ask me, what can they do in their daily lives to make a difference? And here's my suggestion. Visit your local archives or historical society. Support your public libraries. Bring students to museums. Ask hard questions. Demand excellence. Celebrate honesty. And most of all, defend their independence. Let us make America's 250th birthday not just a celebration of the past, but also a recommitment to the future. And let us remember that we are not just inheriting the Republic, we are shaping it. At the close of the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of government the delegates had created. And his answer was simple, enduring, and urgent. A republic, if you can keep it. So to keep it, we must protect the institutions that safeguard our memory. We must tell the full story of America, not to glorify, not to condemn, but to understand. So let us keep the republic by protecting the memory that sustains it. And let me also suggest a practical step forward. As America approaches its 250th birthday, we must reinvest in the muscle memory of self-government, beginning with the next generation of citizens. We need nothing short of a civic education moonshot. Just as we once rallied to improve science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, investing resources and leadership across every level of government, we must now apply the same urgency to civic knowledge and historical understanding. Today, only 13% of eighth grade students are proficient in U.S. history, and just 22% in civics. More than 70% of American adults cannot pass a basic civic literacy quiz. These numbers should alarm all of us who believe that democracy depends upon informed participation. Rebuilding civics education requires a back-to-basics approach. That means ensuring every student understands the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the structure of federalism, and the separation of powers. These are the rules of the game, and without them, the game cannot be played. But that's only the beginning. We must also teach the habits and the practical skills of citizenship, how to deliberate, how to solve problems collectively, and how to respect both majority rule and minority rights. We must teach the value of pluralism and disagreement and give students the tools to navigate a world saturated in misinformation. If we are teaching a generation to code, we also have to teach them how to decode civic life. And most importantly, we have to teach history alongside civics. The record of the past, when taught honestly and without fear, can inspire engagement and reform. It can help students see that our national story is not one of perfection, but of aspiration. A more perfect union is a promise, not a destination. So fortunately, we are not starting from scratch. There is now a bipartisan framework called the Educating for American Democracy Roadmap. It provides states and schools with an accessible plan for improving instruction in civics and history. Experts from across the political spectrum work to put it together. We should encourage our schools to use this tool to ensure that the civics moonshot becomes a reality. Likewise, we need our universities to step up, creating civic centers and expanding relevant course requirements. We should invest more in educating the next generation of teachers about the importance of civics and history in the classroom. The good news is that a nationwide coalition is forming with clear goals, coordinated plans, and some momentum. So I ask you to join me in this work and become part of the solution as we move forward. After all, Lincoln would have demanded nothing less. Thank you.
Colleen Shogan on civics and civic engagement being the key to saving our democracy. More of the 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series after this on Community Voices. Community Voices continues with an event you might have missed, the 2025 Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. Here are questions that were drawn for both Colleen Shogan and the other speaker we heard from on Thursday, Jason Emerson, at the event that was held at the UIS Student Union.
My name is Brian. Me and a few of my coworkers here, about a half a dozen of us, work at the old state capitol here in Springfield, and we get kids every day for a half hour tour, and I know I spend about 15 to 20% of that tour on civics. You specifically said at the end of your talk that we need to teach kids, people, adults as well, more civics. What exactly would you want people like me and my coworkers to focus on, maybe to alter, to change, something that you think would be a better message and some way for us to educate the general populace in a very short period? And a question for the other speaker as well. Since we are on Vachel Lindsay Drive right now, Vachel Lindsay wrote a poem, Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight in Springfield, Illinois, where he specifically talks about some of these things we've discussed. What do you think Vachel or either Abraham would feel about Robert and his view, his sort of anti-labor, anti-equality stance at this time?
I mean, I would say one thing that kids really need to understand, I mean, today is the unique features of American democracy. You know, there's features of democracy writ large, and there's all kinds of different democracies across the world, and we see it implemented in different ways, but there are unique features of American democracy, and what I see sometimes is a misunderstanding of the features of American democracy. So I would focus maybe, you know, you talk about Lincoln or you talk about the role of the president. I would try to emphasize that the president is one actor in a larger system, that there are separated powers in the system for a reason, and maybe go into why. Why did the framers decide that there would be checks and balances on the executive, that what is the role of Congress, what is the role of the courts? Because I think there is a real misunderstanding, I think, today about what the different roles of the different branches, and maybe just that small reminder would be, you know, very helpful. One of the craziest things that I dealt with as archivist, and I didn't talk about it in my speech, was on Valentine's Day in 2024, two younger people came into the National Archives Rotunda and exploded pink powder all over the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, all over the rotunda, and as a protest to advocate for climate change reform in the country. And after these individuals had been detained and were laying there in the rotunda amongst all the pink powder everywhere, and we had gotten the situation a little bit under control, we were waiting for the police to come and take them out of the building. You know, they told me that the reason why they did it was they thought this was a way they could convince President Biden that he had to do more on climate change. And I was like, okay, I thought about it for a second, and I realized almost instantly, oh my gosh, this is a failure. This is a failure of civics, right? They think that this is the way that they can have the most effect to advocate for a cause that they believe in. And I think we need to figure out ways in which we can prevent that, and we can explain that you can be passionate about all kinds of causes, you know, that we have in the United States, but there is a way that we can advocate productively.
Yes. Yeah, so what would Rachel Lindsay or Abraham Lincoln have thought about Robert Lincoln being so anti-union? Oh, I think Rachel Lindsay would have hated Robert. He probably did. They probably lived at the same time. Yeah, Lindsay's an interesting guy. You know, as far as what Abraham Lincoln would think, you know, I've thought about that for years, and I think that's a great question. I don't know if I know the answer. I think that Robert Lincoln generally turned into exactly the man his father wanted him to be. He was successful. He was self-contained. He was very sure of himself, and he did not let people push him around. But he also, you know, he saved all of Lincoln's papers, and he gave them to the American people, put them in the Library of Congress. Without that, there's so much less we would know about Abraham Lincoln. Robert could have done many things with that. He could have sold them all, kind of like his grandkids did. And so I think Abraham Lincoln would have been extremely proud of Robert because, you know, as parents, we all want our children to be more successful than we are. And Robert is often considered one of the most successful presidential children in history. You don't really count John Quincy Adams or George W. Bush because they were presidents, but I mean, Quincy Adams, that's no contest. W. Bush, we could discuss that one, but but as far as, you know, the Pullman stuff, I don't know. You know, I'd like to think that, you know, as a lawyer, as I mentioned, Lincoln, you know, he advocated for his client. And we know he had clients who were people trying to reclaim slaves. I think there was a few of those, wasn't there? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you work for who you work for, and you do your best job with integrity. So I don't know if Lincoln would be proud of Robert for doing his best job for the Pullman Company that he ran, or if he would be disappointed in him for putting profits first above people. I really don't know. I kind of go back and forth on that one. And then I try to think, well, you know, I don't want to be biased. I mean, when it took me almost 10 years to write the biography of Robert Lincoln. So when you spend 10 years on a biography, it's really hard not to really, I don't want to say fall in love with the person, but to really empathize with them and really try to defend them sometimes when maybe they shouldn't be defended. So that is a tough question. That might be one that maybe we should all answer for ourselves. I don't know if I have an answer, but it's a good question.
Are we losing our archives due to changes in technology? Anything currently like the Signal fiasco or the third-party servers? To even in Lincoln's day, did the telegraph really, did those messages get saved?
Oh, yeah, we have a lot of Lincoln's telegraphs at the National Archives. And some famous ones, too, like the Bulldog telegram that he sent to Grant after the Wilderness campaign. When Zelensky came to visit the archives, I showed him the Bulldog telegram, and he was very, very impacted by viewing that telegram. But it's a good question about technology. And listen, I mean, the format of the records shouldn't really matter. It's the law is the same no matter what the format is, but you have to take the law seriously. And the law for federal records retention has always been something that federal employees and senior leaders were encouraged to take seriously and told over and over again repetitively, and have records retention in place, protocols in place, so that those records are retained. But if there's not an agreement that is a serious enterprise and that is something that we want to engage in, it, you know, the technology, whether it's paper, whether it's Signal or whatever it is, you're going to find a way to, you'll find a way to subvert it. So I think that is concerning. I think there is a time in the future, although the National Archives is not prepared for the electronic record or digital record deluge that is going to come at the archives in the next 10 years, like I said, when it's going to go from millions to billions to trillions very quickly. They don't have the technology system in place that was something I wanted to work on as archivist. And, you know, I was starting to have a plan in place about how to do that for the intake of born digital records and then also the ability to share those records. If that would be put in place, though, at a moment in time, and we had all these, you know, all these emails and instant messages and everything, we will have an extraordinarily amazing record to be able to sift through, to piece together stories and to piece together the nature of what happened. But we are not there yet. Like, I can see it's like you're out to sea and you can see land, but you have to get to land first. You know, you're not quite there yet. And we're still out at sea to figure out how that will work. But once we are able to get those systems in place, once there is resources afforded to be able to do that, and we've cracked the code, then there will be an amazing ability to search the records in ways that we can't even imagine right now. And we're limited in doing so now because of the paper or the analog enterprise.
Yeah, as a historian, that's what I was thinking. Just think about how great it would be to just search for keywords rather than, you know, in Lincoln's time, we have to look through all the papers. You know, every once in a while, I'll be looking through papers and I'll find my, you know, I'm getting older and the paper's not as clear as it used to be. And I find myself about to reach up to try to widen it. And I'm like, oh, wait, this is not a computer screen. This is a piece of paper. So, that is one of the good things about technology as a historian. I remember going through old newspapers on the microfilm reels, page by page, and now you can just key search. It's so wonderful.
Hello, my name is Maricela Arce. I'm a graduate student at Liberal and Integrative Studies. A few months ago, the Dear Colleague Letters was published in universities, particularly their programs and or advancement of student life endeavors, may be seemingly caught in the crosshairs of stakeholder engagement and civic participation versus political pressure. What guidance or encouragement to keep going would you provide students or individuals whose efforts to advance cultural, historical, or civic knowledge may currently be finding itself unintentionally suppressed?
You know, I think that I talked about this a little bit at the end, but there is more interest in universities on trying to create centers for civic life, to create programs and initiatives for civic life. And you're starting to see this with some of the bigger universities pop up all across the United States. Now, in some cases, these are popping up because of political pressure, and I worry about whether or not those centers will truly be for all civic participation or if they have certain outcomes in mind. But I do see models that are really positive, like the University of Wisconsin is really trying to grapple with this. Like, how can we create a civics initiative on campus? We are a purple state. How can we create it so that all students here at the University of Wisconsin from all political backgrounds feel welcome and feel agency? So, I think the encouragement from certainly administration and certainly from faculty members who support organizations and clubs and other initiatives on campus, having productive conversations like this one, having, you know, productive dialogues in classrooms that allow there to be political dissent and disagreement, I think fostering that is really, really important. That's one thing that we have to teach young people as well, is that it's okay to disagree, okay? For some reason, you know, there's a lot of conflict aversion amongst, because they've been told, you know, like, that's going to be upsetting to me if we enter into a dialogue or a disagreement. No, I mean, as a professor or someone who's on campus as an administrator, you should be finding ways in the classroom and in organizations in which that dialogue and disagreement can flourish. But it flourishes in a way that's respectful. We don't need people screaming at each other. We don't need people calling names at each other. We don't want people belittling each other. But actually debating and engaging in dialogue that is respectful and productive will teach kids, as, you know, whether they're high school students or college students, then when they become full-fledged citizens and move into communities and there are community problems and issues that they have to work on, they can draw upon those skills that they learned as students to be able to take it into their lives as democratic citizens. It's really important, but you shouldn't run away from conflict. I don't say you should necessarily run into it, but you shouldn't run away from it, and you should figure out a way in which conflict can be resolved in respectable formats.
I'm going to take the last question. And Colleen, I'm going to ask a depressing question, and the onus is on you to give me hope. So I love the idea of a civic moonshot and sort of reinvigorating civics in our country. But we are in the middle of a 20-year experiment where we've replaced our public square with social media apps that pretend to have free speech, but really they're run by logarithms meant to keep us engaged. And they've found out that the best way to keep us engaged is to feed us to things that enrage us. How do we create an operational republic when that is the state of our town square?
Well, I think what I said is truth, is we have to understand how, we have to have the basics of understanding processes, understand how our government actually works, that, you know, we can debate things on social media, but that's, you know, that is not, if you want to influence how outcomes and processes, there is a lot of other avenues that you can engage in if you want to be involved in affecting outcomes in your local government, your state government, you know, your own community, not even necessarily national politics. And I'm not going to say that we should ban social media. We're not going to do any of that, right? And that would be an instance in which probably the cure would be, once again, worse than the disease. But we do have to probably go back to, there's no substitute for actually, before you can engage, like I said, engage in the game, you have to understand the rules of the game. And I don't think people are learning the rules of the basic rules of the game. So maybe we could just start with that. And if people would start to learn some of the, you know, the principles, the basic principles of our government, like I said, in our founding documents, you know, some of the, we can understand the basics. And we all have a good understanding of that. I would just hope that that would help inform eventually our public debate and how we engage with each other. And like I also said, it's not just that, it's also some of the ways in which we treat each other. That also has to be part of our civics education. It isn't just the Constitution and the Declaration and all that stuff that I like studying. It's also trying to teach elements of civility and democratic engagement. Active listening, compromise. What does it mean to negotiate, right? You know, what does it mean to, you and I don't agree, but, you know, how do we both give up something that we can live with and we can both come hopefully halfway in between with each other and come to a resolution? Like, we need to teach that to kids so that when they become adults that they can put that into practice. And I don't think we're actually doing that right now. So I think there's a lot we can do. It maybe won't completely solve the problem that you're outlining, but I think the best we can hope is that we can try to mitigate some of those most damaging and scary, you know, results that you were talking about.
Colleen Shogan, the former archivist of the United States, on how repairing the public square and adapting to new technology are required for us to govern our country. Want to thank the UIS Center for Lincoln Studies and Jake Freifeld for providing the audio, along with the Office of Electronic Media, from this year's 2025 Beaumont Endowed Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series. If there's an event you'd like us to feature on a future Community Voices, contact us at communityvoices@nprillinois.org. One quick note, we have two openings for Community Voices co-hosts. Go to nprillinois.org. You can direct someone to apply there. Someone who would be a good host, has personality, and understands how to work with audio would be key. You can find the job description as part of the posting. We look forward to introducing new co-hosts soon. Community Voices is happy to celebrate 5 years of helping us get to know our neighbors and shedding light on events we may have missed. Community Voices started in 2020 as a vision to respond to the pandemic and the need to get to talk with each other more. We've continued that for 5 years with a variety of tremendous guests coming in. Thanks for being part of the first 5 years of Community Voices.